Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Grant Padalko, an editor on the English language website of RFERL, and I'll be your host this week. Like so many music greats before her, soul singer Amy Winehouse, whose final concert was in Belgrade on June 18th, was 27 years old when she died late last month. On this week's show, we speak about this phenomenon with the authors of the book The 27s, The Greatest Myth of Rock and Roll.
We like that they are gods and goddesses to us. You know, they live at a standard that we will never reach, but yet we also really latch on to their human flaws. You know, every single one of the artists in the 27s, just like every single one of the Greek gods and goddesses, had their Achilles heel.
We visit the Bosnian town of Kalesia, the home of 11-year-old Miralem Ramic, already a gifted soccer player who's being courted by scouts from Italy and Spain.
These coaches are breathless when they see Miralem on the field, because it's unusual for an 11-year-old to play so intelligently. He plays for the team, not just for himself.
We invite Alexei Znatkevich from our Belarus service into the studio to discuss a proposed amendment to the country's law on demonstrations.
Well, it would be comical if it was not so sad, I would say.
And in his monthly Ear to the Ground segment, Romanian journalist and music nut Lucian Stefanescu introduces us to the music of two influential jazz bands, Trigon from Moldova and the Shin from Georgia.
Yes, Divi, Trist, Chevy!
The recent death of British soul and R&B singer Amy Winehouse, who performed the last concert of her life in the Serbian capital Belgrade on June 18th, has revived the myth of the so-called 27 Club. That's the group of influential musicians who all died at the age of 27. Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, Robert Johnson, Brian Jones, and Kurt Cobain among them. Salome Asatiani from our Georgian service spoke about this tragic coincidence and the phenomenon of rock stardom, first with Eric Siegelstad, and then with Josh Hunter. They're the authors of the critically acclaimed book, The 27s, The Greatest Myth of Rock and Roll.
If we could come down to it, so what is it about 27? Can this coincidence be explained somehow, rationally? Is it just this transition from youth to maturity, as many people think it is? Or is it something that has to do with this mounting expectations and the rising levels of stress and that the musicians can no longer handle? They are not in their early 20s anymore. In one of your interviews, you were also talking about this problem of topping yourself in Jimi Hendrix's case, where he had achieved an unthinkable at the age of 27. So there was nowhere else for him to go musically, artistically.
I think the fast and easy answer, I mean, you already touch on it, is that, you know, they reach their, you know, their end of their 20s, and there's mounting pressures, and their bodies aren't as young as they used to be. You know, they might have had a past history of hard substance abuse for in many cases, not all cases, and then, you know, returning to substances that are very harmful, and their body is just not used to handling the same amount or the same grade as they were, you know, used in the past. You know, I think that's sort of the rational explanation for it. But the one thing that is still remains a mystery after all of that said and done is the fact that more musicians have died at this age than at any other age, more famous musicians have. So, you know, why is that? And why is it 27? Why is it not 26? And why is it not 28? I think that's something that it's just really hard to rationally explain, which is why we go into the, you know, the power of the number, and we go into the astrology bits and pieces where, you know, there are probably other explanations out there.
Come as you are, as you were, as I want you to be.
Another example, and we also talk about this in the book, is, you know, if you go back a few hundred years ago when Beethoven was working on his symphonies, you know, he didn't complete his ninth symphony. And for the next 250 years, all the great composers following in his wake, they struggled to and feared to finish their ninth symphony, and they weren't able to. So they all died under, you know, various circumstances, either completing their ninth or in the process of getting started on their ninth symphony. So, you know, that's another really real curse that happened a few hundred years ago. And just from a, you know, if you look at the number itself, it's interesting that, you know, there's the number three, and then 3 to the second, you know, 3 times 3 is 9, and then 3 to the third power is 27. So it's just kind of, it's just fascinating that it happens to be, you know, the same type of base of the number.
To what extent would you say rock stars can be seen as our projections of, could it be that we who are somewhat dissatisfied or we think our lives are trivial or very banal, we project what we can never be onto these musicians, the other side, the wild side, the excess, the sex and nonconformity, the freedom. Do we have these preconceived ideas or stereotypes that we demand of rock musicians to fit into?
I think a tremendous connection to that. I thought early on, you know, I mean, Eric talked about this in creating the book, you know, I see the way that we, you know, if you can, almost hero worship these musicians, someone like, you know, Jim Morrison, for instance, or Jimi Hendrix, who to this day you can go in and buy T-shirts and posters of, and, you know, 16-year-old kids have posters of Jimi Hendrix up on their wall. It's not very unlike the Greeks and gods and sculptures of the past, you know, centuries before us or millennia before us.
Now dig this, baby. You don't care for me. I don't care about that. You got a new fool.
So I do think that they, you know, we look at these stories and, you know, we like that they are gods and goddesses to us. You know, they live at a standard that we will never reach. But yet we also really latch on to their human flaws. You know, every single one of the artists in the 27s, just like every single one of the Greek gods and goddesses, had their Achilles heel. And I think that we project a lot of our wants and desires onto them, you know, whether they be, you know, Jim Morrison or Kurt Cobain or someone that we really look up to and want to be. But at the same time, you know, we kind of live our life, we live our life through them, because we can't, like you said, we can't achieve what they've been able to achieve. We can't go out and meet all the women or the men that these people can. We can't go out and party all night and jump on a plane and fly to another country and do it all over again. So I do think that there is maybe a grossly unfair justification of expecting these people to be perfect. But I think that that's kind of the world that we live in. We like to bash people when they make mistakes. I mean, how else can you really explain the fact that, you know, 2 weeks ago when Amy Winehouse comes on stage and she's apparently, you know, looks intoxicated and not playing well, and she gets booed off stage. And, you know, I can only think in my mind that, you know, before she went on stage, she probably, you know, may have even questioned whether she wanted to be there, and yet she's got people that are encouraging her to do so because the crowd is there to hear her. They want to hear her perform. They want to hear her song. And so she walks out there and she tries to give her gift and tries to sing. You know, granted, she probably shouldn't have done so, but she did. And she gets booed off stage to a raucous, you know, crowd that, you know, despises her at that moment. I just can't really understand what that must be.
And then she dies and she becomes everybody's hero, including people who were booing her off.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you are so right. And, you know, I think that already, I mean, I just appreciate the questions you're asking, because I feel like this is the level that this conversation needs to be held at. It's not all the dirty, gross details. It's what were these? These are real people that felt real things, and we applauded them when they did well. We booed them when they did bad, or we thought that they did not perform up to a standard that we wanted. But you know what? 99.9% of us have never written a song and never been on stage before, have never sold 5 million albums, never won a Grammy. And yet we feel like we have a right to, you know, judge these people. And yet we would never want anyone to do it to ourselves. But that's where we are.
You've got to give them A for effort. Activists in Belarus have displayed a remarkable degree of creativity as they protest against the authoritarian government of President Alexander Lukashenko. For example, they've set the alarms on their cell phones to go off simultaneously, and most famously have gathered to clap their hands in public. Now, in an effort to stifle even these mild forms of protest, the authorities are moving from the sublime to the ridiculous. I invited Alexei Snatkevich from our Belarus service into the studio to explain. Welcome to the Blender, Alexei.
Hello.
I understand that the authorities in Minsk have proposed an amendment to the country's law on demonstrations that would make it a crime for Belarusians to assemble for, quote, a previously planned action or, and this is what's amazing to me, a previously planned inaction. Now, this sounds almost comical. Actually, it does sound comical. Can you explain what this amendment means exactly?
Well, it would be comical if it was not so sad, I would say. I think what it means is the authorities are trying to get some legal basis for repressions that have been going on for a couple months already, for the last couple of months. What they were doing before, they were arresting people and charging them with petty hooliganism, with swearing in public, with maybe urinating in public sometimes or whatever. Now they will be able to just arrest them for standing quietly, silently in public space and expressing by these some kind of protest. So basically what these amendments mean is that the authorities would have legal basis for the things they have been doing for, in some cases, for a couple of months, in some cases for many years, like cordoning off public space where the supposed protests are planned. So, for example, the police have been cordoning off this for years already. Now, according to these new amendments, they have the right to do so.
Right. And this new amendment is likely to pass, right?
Well, unless something major happens. Unless some weird thing happens in Alexander Lukashenko's head and he orders for the parliament not to pass it, so then the parliament will pass it, definitely.
From the outside, this does seem comical. What's the reaction inside Belarus to these kind of things? I mean, is it sort of just a resignation that this is the way things are, or are people laughing? Or
yeah, some people laugh at this. I mean, the phrase previously planned inaction, in any language, it sounds a little weird. So yes, people are laughing at that, but after things that have been happening in Belarus with these protests, for example, a person with one hand arrested for clapping, for example. Which happened, or the famous case, which was quite a few years ago, when they arrested a deaf and dumb person and charged him with shouting the anti-government slogans. And the guy was arrested for that. Later they changed the charges, but initially in the police protocol it was written that he was shouting anti-government slogans. So,
well, as we mentioned, you know, the latest protests are having people clapping their hands, and one of the new innovations is I think everyone set their cell phones to have their alarms go off at a certain time. The Belarusians seem to have a particular knack for some creative ways to protest the government. Is that something in the Belarusian nature, or why Belarus?
What I think it's just the way to try to show the absurdity of the actions by the authorities. So what were people saying is just, you know, you are arresting us for protesting in some way, for protesting with some slogans, with some statements. So what do you do if we just come out and stand there and don't say anything, don't do anything? And the police still was acting brutally. I mean, there was a joke in the Soviet times that a person was arrested just for reading Pravda and making the face, like, very sad face. Oh, there was another joke when a person came out with a clean sheet, blank sheet of paper and was standing there, and the police came to him and asked, what is it? Why do you have this blank piece of paper? And he says, well, everybody understands everything, so there's no need to write anything on that. So basically, people were just expressing this kind of protest without doing anything, without stating anything, without making any obvious statements.
Where do you see the anti-government movement going? Is it just going to sort of simmer like this, or is there any hope for any sort of movement?
I think the politicians in the opposition who are still not in prison, they very much hope for some kind of another wave of protests in the fall, when people come back from their dachas and see what's happening. Like, people very much hope, people in the opposition very much hope that the economic crisis will force more and more apolitical people to join the protest in some form.
Well, thank you very much, Alexei, for coming on to The Blender.
Thank you.
Mirlem Ramic is only 11 years old, but he's pretty sure he knows what he wants to do with his life. And he's getting a lot of encouragement and support from his parents, who first noticed his talent, from his coach, and from talent scouts around Europe. Nikolai Pavlov reports.
For an 11-year-old boy, Mirlem Ramic has some tough choices to make. Madrid or Milan? Or how about Manchester United? Some of Europe's biggest soccer teams already have their eyes on this young talent from the Bosnian town of Kalesia. Scouts from Italy and Spain have even invited him to take part in their training camps.
I had a
wonderful time. Every morning when I came to play, they were hugging me and we played together. The coaches always said, bravo Mira, whenever I did something well. This means that I can do a lot, but I can do even better. I'd like to learn how to speak Italian. I hope that everything will work out okay.
Mirlem was just 5 years old when his father, Ramo, noticed his son's special talent.
I discovered his ability when he was little. He wasn't even 6 years old. He would kick any plastic bottle, and I saw that he wanted a ball. His coach, Suleiman Sinanovic, gave him his first ball, and then he really showed his talent. The coach realized in 5 minutes that Mirlem could achieve something. With God's help, he has succeeded.
Miralem's mother, Safka, believes her son is unique.
Of all the children in Kalesia, there is only one like him. There are other children who play soccer, but none of them are like him. I'm very proud of my son. He's already traveling around Europe at the age of 11, and Sinanovic is supporting him in that. We, his parents and whole family, are supporting him. I can only admire my son.
Miralem's coach says the boy's ability stands out even in the eyes of professionals.
These coaches are breathless when they see Miralem on the field, because it's unusual for an 11-year-old to play so intelligently. He plays for the team, not just for himself. Other kids his age just hold the ball all the time and don't want to give it to anybody. His biggest value is that he plays for the whole team, for the collective.
Miralem's parents realized that nurturing his talent might mean sacrificing some parts of their normal family life.
It's hard to decide to let an 11-year-old travel around the world. But what can I do? It's his career. And he has wanted to play soccer all his life. So that's it. I want to watch him play like Ronaldo on the pitch.
That's Cristiano Ronaldo, the Portuguese striker who is also Miralem's idol. And Miralem's classmates are calling him Messi from our street, in reference to Lionel Messi, the celebrated Argentinian striker. But it's not just the chance to be a star that attracts Miralem. He says he also wants to make his family and his country proud.
I'd like to become someone, to be something big, so that people will talk about how one little boy from Bosnia plays for a really tough team.
That was Nikolai Pavlov reporting.
Just a reminder that The Blender is the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe. RFE brings radio, internet, and television news programming to 21 countries across the former Soviet Union, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, and the Balkans. If you'd like to get in touch, it's very, very easy. drop us a line at podcast@rferl.org or leave a comment on the Blender section of our website. And remember, you can download episodes of The Blender from our website or by subscribing on iTunes. A new episode is posted every Friday.
In our monthly Ear to the Ground segment, Romanian music journalist Lucian Stefanescu introduces us to diverse and often overlooked bands from RFERL's broadcast region. Here's Lucian.
Hello there, my name is Lucian Stefanescu. Welcome to a new edition of Ear to the Ground, the monthly musical section of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty podcast, The Blender. Two jazz bands today, Trigon from Moldova and The Shin, a Georgian band formed in Germany, together with a very special guest, the Romanian jazz critic, poet, professor and diplomat Virgil Mihaiu, who will explain why these two bands are among the most important jazz groups in the region. Trigon formed in 1992 in Chișinău, the capital city of Moldova, and they are the main organizers of the International Ethno Jazz Festival, which takes place each year in Chișinău. They were discovered by Mihail Alperin, a famous Ukrainian musician who used to live in Moldova and now is professor at the Norwegian Academy of Music in Oslo. Trigon call themselves an ethno jazz band. Why ethno? I put this question to Virgil Mihaiu, jazz critic, founder of the jazz department and professor of jazz aesthetics at the Music Academy in Cluj, a member of the Downbeat Jazz Critics Poll and of the International Editorial College of Downbeat, the famous jazz magazine in Chicago. Virgil Mihaiu.
It's because that province of Bessarabia had a long history of national repression, and the only free way to express yourself was music. Actually, it was the only place where they could even pronounce Romanian words. So that's why the tradition of dancing and music has been preserved so well. And after 1991, when they achieved independence, they transformed it into an asset for this excellent type of music. This is a group that has managed to stay together and develop a coherent corpus of teamwork for about 20 years. And of course, to cut a long story short, from the very beginning, Trigon proposed a refined synthesis between the Romanian musical tradition and the cosmopolitan spirit of jazz. Their trademark music has a rare capacity to tug at the heart of various audiences from all over the world, even if not all of their listeners are familiar with the paradoxical rigors implied by jazz's freedom. And they have this great advantage of having this character, Anatol Ștefănuț, who is the best viola player in today's jazz and who has managed to focus on the best talents in this field.
Cavalicoda, played by the Moldovan band Trigon, a very busy band this summer, concerts in Stockholm and Kiev, a new album due in October, Moldova Calls, a Moldovan, Dutch and German project, and also in October a concert at the famous jazz venue in Vienna, Porgy and Bess.
Yes, TV, Trist, Chey!
Let's talk about now about one of the projects that Trigon has, which is the Port of Culture, the joint project between Latvian, Georgian and Moldavian musicians and dancers. One of the bands that is involved in this project is The Shin, a Georgian band, and I know that you performed along these guys.
I would have been very glad to be able to perform. I just presented them in some Italian festivals because I was amazed by their records. It also started not as a trio, but as a duo between Zazamin Minoshvili, the guitar player, and the bass player,
Zurab
Kaknitze, who is fabulous. And it's very strange because it has, like everything in Eastern Europe, it has a lot of geo-historical connections. Actually, one of the names of Georgia is Iveria, which of course means Iberia, because they are supposed to be some relatives of the Basque, and which explains their perfect collaboration with the best Spanish jazz musicians, even with Paco de Lucía, even with Chano Dominguez, even with the incredible bass player Carles Benavent. And when I realized their potential, I presented them to the strongest Italian audiences and festivals, and they were invited to Rocella Ionica, where I was very glad to explain such things on stage in Italian.
Okay, Virgil Mihaiu, jazz literary critic, poet, polyglot, and professor and diplomat, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
I should also mention that Virgil Mihaiu is the director of the Romanian Cultural Institute in Lisbon, where he organizes extremely popular jazz concerts and performances by musicians and artists from all over the world. And he himself is a performer, because he is co-founder of Jazzographics, a loose jazz poetry outfit displaying various stage combinations of the following artists: Alan Tomlinson, trombone, member of the London Jazz Composers Orchestra; Harit Avitian, piano; Cornelius Troy, percussion; Virgil Mihaiu, poetry and bass guitar; Alexandru Balanescu, violin; and Livia Tulbure, choreographic improvisations. He performed either together with Jazzographics or alone in Ireland, Scotland, Romania, England, Austria, United States, and many, many other countries. Coming back to the Shin, let me quote what Petr Doruška, a Czech journalist, wrote about them. The Shin, a Georgian band based in Germany, comes from a melting pot that still has to be discovered, Caucasus. A cradle of ancient cultures, crossroads between Christianity and Islam, a bridge between Asia and Europe, and an extremely rich source of musical traditions, from Georgian polyphony to dreamlike tunes and wild dances of joy. End of quote. You are listening to the KGB song played in concert by the Shin and Ols Ethnographic Orchestra, a Latvian band, at the Dailet Theatre in Riga, the end of 2009. And one more thing, in Georgian, Shin means coming home. My name is Lucian Ștefănescu. Thank you for being with us. Stay tuned to The Blender.
Thanks, Lucian. And that's all the time we have for this week. As always, thanks for turning on the blender. We'll leave you this week with a bit of Amy Winehouse singing Back to Black. Take care, everybody.